Tehran, the streets of London, and Dublin itself has seen some of the largest protests that this country has ever seen on the issue of Palestine. And so I do think there is a massive paradigm shift that is taking place across the globe. And at the same time, we're also seeing a shift within the way in which the Palestinian people are being portrayed in the media. And we are seeing, and I think that part of this is because of the cruelty on the one hand, but also I think that we must recognize the tenacity and the resilience of the Palestinian people that have not given up. Over the last 75 years, they have been waging a struggle. They have been insisting on their right to exist. And at the same time, they have been supported by their partners in the international solidarity movement.
I'm sure we will talk about the fact that the Palestinian resistance is there. It's not going to go anywhere, and no amount of brutal force is going to crush it. We'll get to that later. But let me ask Matthew this, and that is the number of people who have been murdered. Nearly 12,000, among them thousands of children. How do you see this? Is this use of brutal force, barbaric force, an aim by Israel to tell its citizens, because it's, you know, myth of invincibility, that they're providing security, was shattered on October 7th?
I think that's right. I mean, traditionally, when there has been a flare-up in this conflict, Israel seems to have visited 10 to 15 times the casualty rate on their Palestinian enemy, as they see it. So it looks like they're already around about that figure now. Mm-hmm. But I think what is different about this particular phase of this long-running 75-year conflict is that I think there will be some kind of decisive political change, however that's manifest, that will affect the actual living conditions and the actual political structures of Israel and Palestine from now on. So I don't think it's just going to be a matter of Israel feeling like it's killed enough people mm-hmm. for it to feel secure. I think they're going to, in addition to doing that, mm-hmm. I think they're going to impose some kind of, or try to impose some kind of new political structure. But I think it does also, in terms of a human cost, I think we're still looking at several thousand people more that are going to lose their lives before Israel is even going to reveal that plan or it start to implement that plan in any meaningful way. And of course, Israel may not succeed, which could further elongate the escalation.
And that figure I mentioned excludes the people who are under the rubble and presumably dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's put this next question to Mohammed. We are still digesting the vote against a ceasefire in the UK Parliament and the UN vote in favor of a humanitarian pause. How did you see it?
Digesting it, I don't think that those of us in the global south even expected it. I think that we have become so used to the idea of a useless Western program of human rights and so-called speak of international law that in many ways those of us in the global south have learned a long time ago that international law and the idea of human rights is only reserved for Western countries and that it only gets used and weaponized against African countries, countries in South America, countries in Asia and elsewhere. So I think that in some ways this the last 4 weeks has really stripped the West and has really exposed the global North for the kind of facade that it has been imposing on the global community, but specifically on when it comes to international politics and when it comes to international law. In many ways, those of us in the global south and come that are viewing the ways in which the US, the way in which Britain and the European Union have reacted to this, to the current onslaught, to the current violence and to the current attacks on the Gaza Strip. And many of us are asking not about the humanity that lies in Gaza, but we're really asking if the West actually possesses any sense of morality, any sense of humanity, when it is allowing these kind of attacks to take place. And so in some ways, whilst we have lost hope in the West as coming to save or coming to assist or coming to stop this kind of violence. I think that at the same time, we do appreciate international law, we do appreciate human rights, but we are going to make sure that they are implemented, that they are implemented universally, that they are implemented without any prejudice to one group of people over another.
Right, which begs the question, you know, where do Palestinians draw their hope from? They have lost hope in the Western world, the Arab countries who own 1/6 of the world's wealth. They're not doing enough to put an end to the bloodshed, to say the least. But, gentlemen, we're going to pause here because we're going to hear from the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, called on U.S. President Joe Biden to personally intervene to stop the war in Gaza. In a televised address broadcast over the weekend, Abbas spoke of the worsening humanitarian crisis in the besieged enclave.
President Biden, I urge you with all your official and humanitarian qualities to stop this humanitarian catastrophe, or rather this genocide against our innocent people, for which history will hold no one innocent, and to provide relief to our people trapped in Gaza. This war must be stopped immediately. How can this genocide be justified as self-defense? In reality, they're war crimes that deserve punishment. The horrific massacres committed by the Israeli occupation forces against our Palestinian people in Gaza, including the most recent ones in Al-Fakhura and Tel Zatar schools today, which claimed the lives of hundreds of forcibly displaced people from their homes, once again compel me to demand that you and world leaders assume responsibility to stop this aggression and the crimes of genocide against our people. So far, over 42,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, have fallen victim, in addition to the widespread destruction of tens of thousands of homes, schools, hospitals, places of worship, public facilities, and infrastructure.
And we're back with our guests to continue the conversation. Matthew, I want to pick up on something we were discussing earlier, and that's the United Nations. And when it comes to resolutions adopted against Iran, for example, remember the Iraq War and the, you know, vial that Colin Powell held at the United Nations to justify the invasion of Iraq in 2003. The UN seems to be able to implement those resolutions. But when it comes to Palestinians or the Gaza Strip or what's happening right now, it's completely toothless. Are they losing legitimacy altogether?
I think the United Nations is a great institution. I've been to the United Nations, and it's inspiring, really. But it's been toothless for a very long time. There was the hope, as I'm sure you know, in the aftermath of the Cold War in the 1990s, that the UN could finally be the thing that it was set up to be, to promote peace and self-determination, which is, of course, very relevant to the Palestinian people right now. And there was a growth in the relevancy of the United Nations in the 1990s, but only because it was driven so hard by the United States, and only because the United States was having its unipolar moment, its most powerful moment. Mm-hmm. After 9/11, the role of the United Nations, even that little uptick that it had in the 90s, it's really been a particularly toothless tiger since then. It's great that international law is there, and that's been set up by all of these countries working together, and it's so important for peace, security, and justice. But the last 20 years, it's not really been able to fulfill that mandate whatsoever.
Now, I mentioned we would be talking about apartheid Israel and apartheid South Africa, and Mohammed, this is a question for you. In the words of Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki, if there is any country or countries that can comprehend the suffering and the struggle for freedom and independence of Palestine, it is the African continent and the people of Africa. As a South African watching these horrific events unfold, how do you see it all as far as apartheid is concerned?
So, Saeed, let me first maybe start off backwards. In some ways, what we are seeing is far, far worse and more horrific than what South Africans ever experienced during the days of apartheid. We never had F-16 bombers and Apache helicopters flying over our townships or flying over our residential areas, dropping bombs, missiles, and destroying entire buildings. We never saw the kind of death rate that we are currently witnessing in the Gaza Strip. So in many ways, the very definition of Israel as an apartheid state is soon becoming irrelevant, because we are more beginning to see it as a genocidal state. Our own president, and I don't use these words lightly, our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa, most recently has described what is happening to the Palestinian people as a genocide and as a Holocaust. Our ruling party, the African National Congress, has also made similar remarks, similar statements. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, the head of cabinet, the minister responsible for communicating all decisions from our administration, have all in the last 4 weeks described what is happening as a Holocaust and as a genocide. And so I do think that these two other words and definitions now need to be interrogated. However, to go to the issue of apartheid, I think that from the early 2000s, this is when the terms first started gaining traction. And it started gaining traction in a mainstream sense when the World Conference Against Racism took place in Durban in South Africa. It was at this conference that organizations and governments started labeling Israel as an apartheid state in protest against the criticism that Israel and the Israeli regime was facing. The United States and Israel then boycotted and left that conference early. Thereafter, you have seen anti-apartheid icons, from Winnie Mandela to Archbishop Desmond Tutu and to various others across the board, that have described the situation of the Palestinian people as being very similar to that of the experience of Black South Africans under apartheid. However, I think that what has happened in the last 5 or 6 years is that we are now seeing not just a comparison between Israel and Israel's practices against the Palestinians to that of what apartheid South Africa imposed against Black South Africans. We're not just seeing a comparison, but we're also seeing a legal case being made that Israel that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid as defined by the Rome Statute and by the International Convention on the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid. I think that the United Nations and especially the ICC's prosecutor, who comes from Britain actually, has had ample evidence put forward to him by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, by B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, and various others. And I really do think that it is that it is concerning that the prosecutor within the ICC has not made any substantial moves in order to prosecute and in order to bring Israel to the ICC.
It certainly is concerning. There are a lot of words, there's a lot of evidence, but we're yet to see any concrete action on the ground by these organizations and institutions. Let me move on to Matthew, if that's okay. And Matthew, do you think this is a tipping point? You know, in the 1980s, I think it was 85, when the minority rule in South Africa realized, look, you can crush the resistance, they're here to stay. And that sort of led to the downfall, if you will, or dismantlement of the apartheid system in the 1990s. Are we at that tipping point here in the territories?
I think it's a really important question. It's very difficult to predict the future. Obviously, apartheid became an international lightning rod in the mid-1980s, but it still took another 5 years for actual on-the-ground results to occur. It might be that we're at that stage now with Palestine. it's I definitely think it is encouraging that there were a million people out, or close to a million people out on the streets in London just a week ago. Mm-hmm. And as I say, that it's spread into all sorts of other towns and cities and around the world. So I think this might be the kind of Black Lives Matter for Palestine, and that could have very serious and important ramifications for changing the world. Is it a tipping point? Very difficult to know. It's very difficult to know. There's certainly not much talk at the moment of a what a tipping point would mean, which would be a Palestinian state.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at the moment, I think it's one of those things that, you know, the night is darkest just before the dawn. So
you don't think the end is nigh, so to speak?
Well, the end might be nigh in a different way, particularly if the conflict spreads. Mm-hmm. We do have there's a broader concern here, which takes us a little bit away from the initial humanitarian disaster that's going on, which is that, of course, a conflict like this could escalate. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've had similar situation in Ukraine as well. Yes. Since February 2022 in particular. And there is, of course, the other geostrategic fault line, which is in the Taiwan Straits, I know, and with China. Mm-hmm. And so there are these three areas at the moment, all of which could go spectacularly out of hand. And then your question of the is the end nigh would take on a rather an even darker and more sinister meaning.
So far, only the threat of that happening.
Yeah.
It's a matter of wait and see, like they say. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Matthew, the story about the, you know, calls for criminal investigations into Israeli war crimes. So there's one thing. We're seeing certain countries, not all of them, of course, withdrawing, recalling their ambassadors. Mm. There's a call for boycotting Israeli products or cutting economic ties with it. Do you think it's going to become a trend? Or will all of this, any of this, have any real impact on the Israeli regime moving forward?
I think a lot of it depends on the intransigence of the American empire. I think they are very consciously aware of how their reign as the global hegemon is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And whether they're in denial about that, or certainly they know that they need to do something about that if they want to maintain that power. And Israel is a key part of that. Mm-hmm. Israel, as President Biden has said before, if Israel didn't exist, then we'd have had to have invented it. And that is because it is their strategic outpost for economic and political domination in that region. So it's going to be very difficult for the United States leadership to pull back from that. That's their stated position. That's where they really want to be.
Yeah.
And this can lead to perverse results as well, which can be really horrific. I was just thinking back to one of Fahima's stories that she picked up about this separation of north and south in Israel. I mean, it's the
in
case.
In
Gaza. It's the case in during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. I looked at the statistics on this a few months ago. Obviously, the United States was there to protect the south of Vietnam, because that was where the democracy supposedly was, and against the communist dictatorship north. Over two-thirds of the bombs that were dropped were in the south.
Wow.
Because they were, you know, that old saying, you know, we had to destroy the village to save it. They basically destroyed a country to save it. Mm-hmm. And didn't do anything like as much in the north. Mm-hmm. So these kind of acts of domination can lead to very very extreme and extremely destructive and perverse results. And those kind of things are going to start to happen now as this conflict heats up even further, particularly if we, I think, go beyond Christmas. I think there's a kind of a tacit understanding and acceptance that perhaps this is going to wind up sometime in December.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then all bets are off as to where this goes. I know that the Arab countries don't really want to be involved,
yeah,
but how can they justify that to their populations if we go into the new year and we're still in the same position?
You raise a very good question. Mohammed, this has been a PR battle as well as a physical one. It seems there are still attempts to shape the media narrative in this conflict. How do you see it?
So I think that, as Matthew had said, that the tipping point, the end of this, the end of and the dismantling of Israeli apartheid, in many ways will happen as the way in which it happened in South Africa, where it was a multitude of factors that then contributed towards the demise of the apartheid regime. It was the armed struggle, which played a vital and crucial role in our own liberation. It was the international community, and it was a civil disobedience on the ground and the underground as well. And so I think that likewise in the in this current situation that we are witnessing, I think that global empire and the U.S. domination is one factor, and that is already being challenged by, for example, the formation of BRICS or the rise of certain Latin American countries or Iran or various other countries to counter the sort of hegemony of the United States. Now, coming to the next part of it is the international, as you have put it, the sort of PR battle, the media battle. And I think that whilst on the one hand, U.S. platforms or U.S.-owned, U.S.-dominated platforms such as the Meta-controlled Instagram and Facebook, whilst we do have restrictions and we do have shadow bans and we have other sorts of limitations that people are experiencing, I think that we have, for one of the first times ever, we have seen, while notwithstanding these restrictions, we have seen the ability of Palestinian voices to be coming out onto the global stage. Whereas before, all media was controlled by the Israeli regime, any messaging had to go past the Israeli authorities. Now we are seeing people with their cell phones, with their IT gadgets, that are able to take this information and able to transfer it and communicate it into the international and global community. And I do think that this year is part of the mobilization that we are witnessing.
Exactly. And a lot of people you talk to tell you that they know someone in the Gaza Strip and they're in touch, and that's why these images have been getting out and spreading across the world, raising awareness about what's happening there. We are coming to the end of the show. Let me thank my guests once again, Matthew Alford and Mohammed Desai. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Envy versus Emulation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the most offensive vices and faults is envy. It is a feeling of ill will and dislike for some favor given to someone and wishing for it to be removed from that person. Any action which comes from evil motive has been disapproved and forbidden in Islam. Notice that it's not just simple jealousy. There is a special condition and state of mind that is being referred to over here in this spiritual disease. So when we talk about envy, it's not just, you know, you're jealous of someone. No. What is that special condition? What is that state of mind? Let's talk a little about it. The first special condition is that someone possesses a positive trait or a quality or a blessing. Okay? Number two is that you wish that that blessing be removed from that person and be given to you. So if you notice, it's not just that you're jealous and you want the same thing. No, there is an additional clause to it, and that is that you want that blessing to be taken away from that person and given to you. So see how it is troubling at different levels. It's not just one level. Simple, plain jealousy is bad enough. But here, you're wishing ill for the other person, the believer out there. right? You cannot wish something negative for a believer. Okay, this is not approved in Islam. This is something that is forbidden by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, you know, we will, after the break, talk about how does emulation differ from envy. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing envy versus emulation. We said that envy is bad and forbidden in Islam. There is another feeling which is almost similar to this, that is emulation, which is accompanied by no dislike, and the person doesn't wish for that blessing to be removed or taken away from the other person. It should not be counted as a vice, because you're not ill-wishing for another believer anymore. Okay? At times, this feeling is good and recommended for believers. Let me give you a quick example. When we look at a spiritual personality and we feel the urge to emulate them, this is not a vice by any means. In fact, a believer should try to emulate all the positive traits that anyone carries. Looking at the personalities such as Ayatollah Behjat, looking at personalities such as Imam Khomeini, Imam Khamenei, Ayatollah Sistani, all the big and revered personalities of Islam, when you look at them, you try to emulate them, right? And then when you read about the infallibles, the Imams, you try to emulate them. You try to walk their seerah. You try to adopt their seerah. Right? This is not bad. This envy is different from emulation. In envy, you look at somebody's positive quality that you do not possess in yourself, and you want that positive quality or trait or distinction to be taken away from that person. This is where it becomes problematic. And then you expect that that quality be given to you. So, you know, you read the lives of Shuhada, for example. You know, it inspires you, right? That is emulation. And that is not a vice. Okay? Envy is a vice.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a judge has found that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection by inciting the January 6th riot, but said he could still appear on Colorado's primary ballot next year. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A Denver District Court judge has issued a ruling that former President Donald Trump can appear on the Colorado primary ballot. The decision came down just before 5 p.m. on Friday, 17th of November. At issue was whether Trump was barred from the ballot by a provision of the U.S. Constitution that forbids those who engage in insurrection from holding public office. Colorado's Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, released a statement shortly after the ruling. The court determined that Donald Trump is eligible to be placed on the Colorado ballot in the March presidential primary. This decision may be appealed. As Secretary of State, I will always ensure that every voter can make their voice heard in free and fair elections. Advocates this year have been trying to remove Donald Trump from the ballot in Colorado and other states under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which bars from office those who swore an oath of allegiance to uphold the U.S. Constitution and then engaged in insurrection against it. The measure has only been used a handful of times since the period after the American Civil War. At the end of the day, Colorado voters are going to be able to choose who they want for president, and that's what matters, said Trump's attorney and former Secretary of State, Scott Gessler. In her decision, Judge Sarah B. Wallace said she found that Donald Trump did in fact engage in insurrection on 6th of January 2021 and rejected his attorney's arguments that he was simply engaging in free speech. Normally, that would be enough to disqualify him under Section 3, but she said she couldn't do so for a presidential candidate. I'm surprised at the way the order was structured. Usually, what will happen in courts of law will decide first whether or not the law applies even before we go forward to a trial. In this instance, however, we have a trial, and then she ruled that the law didn't apply. Section 3 does not specifically refer to the presidency, as it does members of the U.S. Senate or House of Representatives. Instead, the clause refers to elector of president and vice president, along with civil and military officers. Part of the court's decision is its reluctance to embrace an interpretation which would disqualify a presidential candidate without a clear, unmistakable indication that such is the intent of Section 3, the judge wrote. The judge, Sarah Wallace, said, "It sets up an interesting situation if you think about it." Norm Provisor, a professor emeritus of political science at Metropolitan State University of Denver, Colorado, said, "It sets up an interesting situation if you think about it." Was he involved in insurrection? Yes, except the president wasn't meant to be covered. Gessler was glad to take the victory in a court of law. The judge threw a lot of shade on President Trump, and you know, we'd rather not have that. At the end of the day, though, we won this. The Trump campaign released a statement saying in part, "We applaud today's ruling in Colorado, which is another nail in the coffin of the un-American ballot challengers." The lawsuit was filed by six Republican and unaffiliated voters backed by the left-leaning group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. NBC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A Colorado judge on Friday, 17th of November, dismissed an effort to keep former President Donald Trump off the state's ballot in 2024. Colorado District Judge Sarah B. Wallace issued a ruling in the Trump ballot eligibility case, ordering the Colorado Secretary of State to place Donald Trump on the state's primary ballot for next year. The ruling is another victory for Trump after courts in Minnesota and Michigan this month rejected similar legal efforts to disqualify him from running for president in those states. A group of Colorado voters filed a legal challenge to Donald Trump's candidacy in September, arguing that his efforts to overturn the 2020 election results and his conduct surrounding the 6th of January 2021 riot at the Capitol violated Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, making him ineligible for holding public office. In her ruling, Judge Sarah B. Wallace found that Donald Trump did engage in an insurrection by inciting a riot on 6th of January 2021, but that the president is not subject to Section 3 because he is not an officer of the United States. She disputed that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment applied to Donald Trump, noting that the clause in question explicitly lists all federal elected positions, but it does not include the president. While the court agrees that there are persuasive arguments on both sides, the court holds that the absence of the president from the list of positions to which the amendment applies, combined with the fact that Section 3 specifies that the disqualifying oath is one to support the Constitution, whereas the presidential oath is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, Judge Wallace wrote. The judge added, "It appears to the court that whatever reason the drafters of Section 3 did not intend to include a person who had only taken the presidential oath." Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and several law firms filed the lawsuit on behalf of Colorado voters. An attorney for the group of voters who filed the legal challenge said they would appeal the decision. The court found that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection against the Constitution after a careful and thorough review of the evidence, attorney Sean Grimsley said in a statement. Sean Grimsley added, "We're very pleased with the opinion and look forward to addressing the sole legal issue on appeal, namely whether Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution applies to insurrectionist presidents. We believe that it does." Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington president Noah Bookbinder said in a statement that the group intends to file the appeal to the Colorado Supreme Court shortly, adding that when they filed this case, we knew it likely would not end at the district court level.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me on this program.
You're welcome. Well, from the last episode onwards, we've started a series of, episodes or programs, on marriage in Islam, right? And some of the jurisprudential laws related to this important concept. Well, you kindly told us about the importance of marriage and how Islam, in fact, underscores marriage and advocates it, and encourages Muslim families, in fact, to consider this and practice this, in fact, in the society. But you also told us about some of the traditions, in fact, regarding the importance of the marriage. But one important question, may cross people's mind or our audience mind, and that is regarding the kind of personal traits or the characteristics that a spouse should have. So what are those traits, what are those features and characteristics can you tell us about the spouse?
That's a very important question. You know, man should give importance to the qualities of a woman he would like to marry. He should not marry a woman except when she is chaste, when she is honorable, of good lineage, righteous, a practicing woman, and of course one who observes hijab, one who prays and fasts. These are the signs of chastity. These are the signs of being a practicing woman. So he should not confine his choice to a woman's physical beauty, a woman's wealth, a woman's appearance. And of course, it has been narrated from the Prophet, peace be upon him, that he said, "Ya ayyuhan nas, iyyakum wa khadra'u ad-daman. Qila ya Rasulullah wa ma khadra'u ad-daman. Qala al-mar'atu al-hasna fi manbati su." Now, this is a very famous tradition, a very well-known hadith. Mm-hmm. The hadith says that, "O people, beware of the green grass in a waste site." Okay. Someone asked, O Messenger of Allah, and what is the green grass in a west side? The Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family said, a beautiful woman and an evil environment. Mm-hmm. So, Al-Mar'atul Hasna fi manbatis su. Now, there are, of course, beautiful women, but every beautiful woman is not a good woman. So, because one should look at her family, at her lineage, at her religion, and the environment she grew up. So, on the other hand, the woman and her guardians should also give importance to the qualities of a man, because it's not a one-sided, approach.
Mm-hmm.
Both the family should take care of the qualities of each other.
Yes.
So a woman should not marry, except a man who is religious, who is of good character, who is not a drunkard, and who sometimes, let's say, commits sins and evil deeds. So, of course, it's very clear, very easy to know about someone's character when one looks at someone's behavior and at someone's
manners,
conduct
thoughts,
in the and when he interacts with other people.
Yes.
One quickly and knows that whether he is a good person or mm-hmm. whether he is a bad person. So there's one thing I would like to mention, and that is that in this time around, we see that girls, men do not want to get married because of economic conditions, mm-hmm. or because they want to live a solitary life without getting married. And while this is very bad, it's a very bad phenomenon that we see nowadays in this time around. And according to the Prophet, peace be upon him, he said, إِذَا جَاءَكُمْ مَنْ تَرْضَوْنَ خُلْقُهُ وَدِينَهُ فَزَوِّجُوهُ إِنَّكُمْ إِنْ لَا تَفْعَلُوا ذَلِكَ تَكُونُ فِتْنَةٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَفَسَادٌ كَبِيرٌ. If someone comes to you whose religion you like, whose personality, whose character pleases you,
mm-hmm.
You have to marry him, okay? If you do not marry him, and in the event that you do not marry him and a mischief occurs, then it is because of you not getting married.
Right.
Yes, because of you not getting married. So it's better not to reject the proposition of a man who is religious and who is of good character and who is a practicing Muslim man.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our programs on Islamic law on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Mohanjad Hossein, this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. The topic we are talking about is hovering around marriage and some of the jurisprudential laws regarding that, and the concept of Islam, or the doctrine of Islam regarding marriage. Well, Sheikh Javed, you told us about the importance of marriage as well as those characteristics. In fact, before the break, regarding a spouse, how to choose or select a spouse, right?
Yes.
One can never marry a person who's not in sound, in fact, mind, for example, or somebody who's out of their leagues, right?
Yes.
So would you tell us about, you know, some of the traditions concerning the necessity of getting marriage?
Well, you know that Islam does not encourage monasticism.
Right.
Monasticism has always been reproached. And those who lived a life of monasticism has always been scolded, reprimanded by Muslim leaders, including the infallible imams. Islam does not want us, on the other hand, to mutilate our genitals in order to be safe, in order to not to fall into sin because of not getting married. We know that the procreation and the continuity of the human offspring depends on marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we get married, we will not have children, we will not procreate, and we will not have any descendants. So this is another reason why marriage is very much important. And I said, as I said, that of course, marriage is indeed very much important and very much necessary from the viewpoint of Islam, because it ensures, it guarantees the safety and the protection of our faith. And if we get married, we definitely safeguard our religion, because if we get married, we will not end up falling into a sin. If you ask the young men and young women as to why they have committed a sin, one of the reasons why they fall into a sin is because of the fact that they didn't get married. So if they are, let's say, gazing at other women, let's say if a man gazes at another woman, it is because he is not married. If a man, God forbid, masturbates, it's because he is not satisfied. He is not married. If a man, for example, goes out, to places like nightclubs, is because he's not married. A married man does not do this.
Yes.
And if a man, watches pornography or forbidden things, it's all because of marriage. If he is married, he is obviously, he is satisfied. He does not have any yearning, any longing, any craving for having to satisfy his lust. As we, of course, the narrations I mentioned in one of the previous episodes.
Thank you very much.
Those are clear proofs that marriage is a must, especially in this time around.
Thank you for joining us on the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we talked about some of the important concepts regarding marriage from the eyes of Islam. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajan ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir ilaha illahum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Israel presses ahead with its airstrikes in the Gaza Strip after agreeing to a temporary truce, which the regime now says will not start until at least Friday. Hezbollah says it has hit several military targets in the north of the occupied territories. Israeli media call one of the strikes the most significant from Lebanon since the start of the war in Gaza. And Iran's president says Israel has failed to achieve its goals in the Gaza war, adding that all the regime's supporters are complicit in its crimes.